You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Thanks so much for braving the rain and the traffic to be with us. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Tamara Wittes, director of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy here at Brookings. And we are really delighted to gather this afternoon, just before we begin our annual Saban Forum, our U.S.-Israel strategic dialogue, to undergird that conversation with some good empirical data and analysis in a fine Brookings tradition. What we'll be doing today is presenting the findings of new survey research by my two colleagues here, Shibli Talhami and Stephen Kull. This survey is part of a series that Shibli and Stephen have worked on together over the years, and I think a number of you have seen Shibli present findings from this work over the years here at Brookings. It's usually once or twice a year we have results from this research. But today is special for a couple of reasons that you will hear about in a few moments. The survey work that Steve and Shibli put together for this round involves some innovative techniques and some truly in-depth investigation. And it's a reflection of the moment that we are in on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. As you all know, final status negotiations resumed at the end of July after a long break, and the two parties have spent the past months engaged in what I think academics might call almost a pre-negotiation process, talking about what they're going to talk about, setting the agenda, figuring out where are the key areas of disagreement. And so here we are a few months in, and we're really approaching the moment of truth for this negotiating process. Where is there room for agreement? What can political leaders in precarious circumstances in a neighborhood in turmoil, what can they viably do and remain leaders, as of course all political leaders wish to do? And that's why this survey research, I think, is so significant, because it is the most in-depth, detailed look that I think we've ever gotten of public opinion on these final status issues and on the whole idea of compromise on behalf of peace. So I'm really grateful to Shibli and Steve for the work they've put into this, and I know that you will be as fascinated as I am by the results. I'm going to invite Shibli up to give you an overview of those findings, present some slides, and then Shibli and Steve will join me on stage for a conversation about the results. So with that, Shibli, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Tammy, and thank you all for coming. You know, allow me just to start by adding my own voice to all those millions around the world who are remembering Nelson Mandela today, in part because this really is a Nelson Mandela moment for the Israel-Palestine question as well, that, as you'll see from the results, in part because he was really a hero to so many of us for what he stood for and the compassion that he showed in overcoming bitterness that we all need. And in part because actually he stood here on this stage, of course, at Brookings in the past, and I had the honor of hosting him to deliver the Anwar Sadat lecture in 2001 with 10,000 people who were, you know, cheering him on at a time when the nation was reeling from 9/11 tragedy, and University of Maryland had been hit by a tornado that killed a couple of students and damaged a lot, and he was there with his voice that provided a healing experience for for the university and for all of us. I think he touched so many of us around the world, and he left the world a better place. So allow me to start with that. I want to now move to this, Paul, and let me tell you just a little bit before I go through it, because I think, you know, as Tammy mentioned, we're in the middle of a negotiation. The administration really identified the goal of a two-state solution for the Israel-Palestine conflict as an American national interest, and the Secretary of State has been saying that this may be the last chance. So we are at a moment where everybody is focused on the details of a final status settlement and not so much on this conceptual idea of whether or not people support a two-state solution. We know that we've had a lot of data, and there's been a lot of excellent polling on this issue over the years, both among Palestinians and among Israelis, and that polling has been very informative, and we've done some of it, but a lot of other people have done it, and they continue to do it all the time. Our aim was to try to go a little bit beyond that to see the limits of what Israelis and Palestinians can bear. Is it really when people say both Israelis and Palestinians are in principle supportive of a two-state solution, is it really the case when you face them with tough details? Or is this just a conceptual idea? They both have, they're talking past each other. They have two different notions of a two-state solution. Or is this really a something that on which they can have common ground? And so to do that, what we did was not only to start with some questions that are typical of a survey on their attitudes, but we devised a package deal of what a two-state solution might look like. And we didn't pull it off thin air. We basically took it out of the discourse of where a lot of people think if there is a deal, it's going to look roughly like this. And it's also based on Clinton parameters, based on what we know of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in the past. And so we pulled the package deal together, and we basically wanted to see the reaction to it. I'll walk you through it in a minute. But I'm going to start by the more depressing side of the story, and that is that what we all know is the case, and that is the pessimism that is pervasive. Let me just say something about the methodology, and obviously we invite some questions when Steve joins me on the stage. We can collaborate more. To do this, we had pretty good sized sample. Among Palestinians, we had 1,003, all face-to-face, both the West Bank and Gaza. And among Israelis, we had a 902 Jews, 151 Arabs. The 151 Arabs were surveyed face-to-face. The Jews were through an internet panel with Israeli pollster Minat Semach of Midgam. So we started off by probing this question that we all know and we hear about all the time, that Israelis and Palestinians are pessimistic about the prospects. We wanted to see how true that is. And sure enough, let's start with the Israelis. Which of the following statements are closest to your view about the prospects of a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians? The current American mediation effort will succeed in reaching an agreement in the next year. Remember, the Secretary of State said 9 months. 4% believe that's going to happen. A peace agreement within the next 5 years, 15%. So you have fewer than 20% say there will be an agreement in the next 5 years. You have 33% say it's inevitable, it'll take more than 5 years, and you have half, 48%, say it'll never happen, and which, by the way, has been actually what we've found the last 2 years. So this finding of half saying it'll never happen is not new. This is what we've been finding. But it's interesting that the commencement of the American mediation effort has not changed that dynamic. If anything, it looks like there's more pessimism. Well, look at the parallel among Palestinians. Only 11% say these negotiations will succeed in the next year. 19% say within 5 years, a little more than the Israelis. 22% say it'll take more than 5 years. And again, half, 47%, say never happen. Again, this is, by the way, parallel to Arab expectations in my other polling finders in six countries in the Arab world, where I find actually a little more than half, about roughly 55%, who think it'll never happen. So that's the reality of where public expectations are. Now, what about confidence in their negotiators and in the American mediation? Let's start with the Israelis. How confident are you that the Israeli negotiators will get the best possible deal in the negotiations? Only 24% are confident in Israel. And by the way, interestingly, Jews are even less confident than Israeli Arabs in their own Israeli negotiators. And in the American mediation, slightly better, if you want to look at it that way, 28% confidence in that American mediation is going to get a fair deal. So again, no confidence. Parallel to the Palestinians, maybe just a little higher, but not much higher, 31% confidence in their own negotiators, 28, roughly the same as the U.S., the Israelis in their own negotiators. So we're starting basically with a lot of pessimism. That's obvious, and I don't think that comes as a surprise to you. Just mapping it out shows how pervasive it is. So that's why I think we felt we need to do something different in terms of doing this simulation, where we present them with a plan, and then don't ask them right away whether they support it or not, but have them debate it, and have them debate it through a set of reactions that we put forth, pro and con of the plan, taken out of the discourse. So that we know what most Israelis who want a peace deal say, why Israelis should do it. We know people who oppose it, what they say. So we try to take many of these common arguments and see how they rank them and get the reaction first before they decide. So because you need, as you know, if you ever have a plan put on the table, it's going to be debated, and you're going to hear every argument. And even when you're putting something that's controversial on the table, people are not going to jump on it right away and vote on it, because it's going to contain so many things LC they don't like. And in fact, when you look at them individually, issue by issue, they're things that are not likely to support. So you need to have this process of have them react to the pro and con arguments. So let me start with how we presented this to them. We used the same exact plan with Israelis, the same exact plan with Palestinians. And so basically, this is what we said to the Israelis. I want you to imagine that you're an advisor to the prime minister. The Israeli delegation have reported back saying that after extensive negotiations, they have the best package deal they were able to get the Palestinians to agree to, and are looking for guidance on whether to agree to accept it as an overarching framework or to end the negotiations. So the terms of the package are as follows. So this is roughly what we also said to the Palestinians. So we used, this is basically the same thing, and then we used the same terms. And let me give you the terms that we put on the table, again, taken out of what many analysts think is roughly something that is likely to be, be the sort of deal they imagine. A sovereign Palestinian state would be established. The boundaries would generally be based on the 1967 borders, but Israel would annex 3 to 4% of the West Bank. That includes major settlement blocks that, with comparable land swaps to be negotiated. Now, that's one, that's the border idea that I think is out there. Two, Gaza and the West Bank would have a secure, unobstructed link, either in the form of a tunnel, highway, or a bridge. For Jerusalem, Israel would have sovereignty over Jewish neighborhoods. Palestinians would have sovereignty over Arab neighborhoods. The walled city would be under a special regime that would include both international control and Israeli-Palestinian participation. Neither Israel nor the Palestinians would have military forces in the Palestinian state, but Palestinian security forces would handle internal security in the Palestinian state. International military forces, such as NATO forces, possibly under American command, would be stationed along the Jordan River. Palestinian refugees would be compensated for loss of property, would be allowed to return to the Palestinian state, with limited number being allowed to return to Israel. Palestinians would recognize Israel, quote, as a state of the Jewish people and of all its citizens. I'll talk about that more later. And seven, Israel and the Arab and Muslim states would establish full diplomatic relations and open trade. Eight, Israel and the Palestinian state would explicitly agree to end the conflict, and Palestinians would relinquish all claims pertaining to the conflict. So that's the package deal. And so the question is, you know, that's what's being talked about. So is this something that Palestinians and Israelis are receptive to? So before we put this to a vote, so to speak, we initiated this reaction on arguments for a deal like that and arguments against a deal like that. We started with the Israelis. So we started by providing them with the pro-argument. So one of the common pro-arguments is if the Palestinians don't have independence in their own state, it's only a matter of time before they start another violent intifada, creating a dangerous and costly confrontation for Israel. A lot of people make that argument. Well, so we asked them whether they find this argument convincing or unconvincing. And you can see that 59% find it convincing, 41% find it unconvincing. We go, and by the way, in descending order of support. So if we don't make a deal to create a Palestinian state, eventually international pressure will grow to accept Palestinians as citizens. And with the growing Palestinian population, it would threaten Israel's Jewish identity. Again, another major argument that is used. 54% find it convincing, but interestingly, 47% find it unconvincing. So Israelis are really divided on this one, not as unanimous as you might expect on the argument. This is an opportune time for Israel to make a deal. Today, Israel is strong, even dominant militarily, with strong support from the United States. Arab states are weakened by the Arab uprisings. In the future, conditions could change for the worse. It is best to make a deal now. Again, half and half, really divided on this one. If Israel does not come to an agreement with the Palestinians, Israel will likely face increasing international isolation. The trend toward imposing sanctions on Israel will only grow with both economic and strategic consequences. Again, you look at this, it's divided half and half. 51 unconvincing, 49 convincing. The pro-arguments again, Israeli-Palestinian peace would make it possible to have normal relations with all Arab states, Arab and Muslim states. This could lead to coordination with Arab states on common threats and a significant expansion of trade. Peace would also eliminate the vast costs of maintaining the military administration in the West Bank and subsidizing the settlements. Here you actually have a majority, slight majority, finding it unconvincing, which is interesting. I mean, I think it's interesting because a lot of people think that one of the lure of an agreement is to have normalized with Arab states, and yet this isn't exactly, you know, a dominant force in Israeli thinking. We have a moral responsibility to seek a solution to the humanitarian plight of several million Palestinians living under occupation or in squalid refugee camps for decades. Now, this is the least convincing argument, interestingly. You have 64% finding it unconvincing and 36% finding it convincing. And remember, by the way, that this is both Arab and Jewish Israelis. So you have roughly 14 to 15% Arabs in this sample who are overwhelmingly on the side of, yes, we have a moral responsibility. So among the Jewish population, it's even less convincing argument. So it's interesting, again, that isn't a something that's dominant. Now, what about the con arguments? Well, you will find that Israelis are far more persuaded by the con arguments, the arguments against an agreement. More intensely, look at the first argument. Even if the Palestinian Authority were to make a deal, it is possible that eventually Hamas will once again control the Palestinian government and simply ignore the terms of the deal. You have 75% say that. Palestinians cannot be trusted with a state next door to our cities. They reject us, and we cannot assume that they would keep the deal not to acquire military forces. And once they do, it will only be a matter of time until they use them to attack us. This is a very common argument, particularly on the right in Israel. And again, three-quarters of Israelis find this convincing. We cannot rely on international control of the walled city and along the Jordan River. Once we relinquish control to international entities, there is no guarantee they won't abandon us and fail to defend our rights and interests. As you know, that's, again, a common sentiment in Israel against international forces. You have almost three-quarters who find this convincing. It's not realistic to have two states because it is just too late. It's impossible to get a large number of settlers out of the West Bank, and the Palestinians will never agree to a Swiss cheese state. We already saw that half of Israelis anyway think it's too, you know, it's never going to happen. So it's not surprising 58% think it's too late. As a matter of principle, Israel should never give up on the West Bank. Should never give up the West Bank. It is an indispensable part of Eretz Israel, the greater Israel. And here you have a little more division, but slight majority basically finds this persuasive. So bottom line is, yes, when you look at the pro arguments and the con arguments, they find many of the pro arguments persuasive, some of them unpersuasive, but they find the con argument far more persuasive, undoubtedly. That's clear. Let me depress you a little more before I open up a little bit of a window of hope. It is not necessary for us to accept this deal. Israel is strong enough to maintain itself as a Jewish state, continue to control the West Bank, keep the Palestinians in the current status, and withstand the pressure from the Palestinians and the international community. Well, even on this, Israelis are divided half and half. So what about for the Palestinians? So let's go through the pro arguments for the Palestinians. If a Palestinian state is not established now, it is unlikely that Israel will accept a one-state solution, and Palestinians will remain under occupation and as refugees for an indefinite period. These conditions are intolerable. A Palestinian state would allow the next generation of Palestinians to live normal lives and to achieve their potential. So here you have most agreement with this argument. 60% say they're persuaded by it, 41% say they're not. Similar support is for if we don't have our own state soon, it's only a matter of time before we have another intifada creating a costly confrontation with Israel with uncertain consequences. Again, two-thirds, nearly 60% find that persuasive. This proposed package is the best we can get for a two-state solution. For those who prefer a one-state solution with equal citizenship, it is unrealistic to hold out for that because Israelis would never accept such an outcome and are in a position to prevent it from happening. So here you have 55% agree with this argument, 46% oppose it. The uprisings in the Arab world are likely to endure for years to come, and Arabs are likely to be preoccupied so that they will not be in a position to help us. We cannot assume that time will be on our side, so it is better to make a deal now. Again, slight majority find that to be persuasive. Time is not on our side. Without an agreement on a two-state solution, we keep losing more land to Israeli settlements every year. It is better to have a state even with limits rather than the status quo and the uncertainty of the future. Again, we have a slight majority, 54%, agree to that. Now, again, you see that a lot of Palestinians actually agree, slight majorities, agree with almost all the arguments, actually, that are presented for. But here's the other side of this, is that they're even more persuaded by the con arguments, not as much as the Israelis, but also, you know, still more than the pros. Any solution that does not allow all Palestinian refugees to return to their original towns in Israel is unjust and simply unacceptable. 63% find this to be persuasive. It is unacceptable for the Palestinian state not to have military forces. The ability to defend ourselves is essential to being a sovereign state. Moreover, Israelis cannot be trusted. They would still have the upper hand and the superior military forces to continue to dominate us without the risk of any cost to them. And 60% agree with that. It is not necessary for us to accept this deal. Time is on our side, even if we have to endure more occupation in the meantime. Eventually, Israel will be forced to accept Palestinians as full citizens or face international isolation. Again, 60% find that persuasive. It's just not realistic to have two states because it's just too late. Again, a similar argument to the Israelis. And here, again, you have 59% find this argument to be persuasive. The Palestinians should have all of historic Palestine. It is better to stay with the status quo than to accept living on only 22% of what the Palestinians rightfully deserve. And you have 57% accept that, 42% say no. So when you here you have a debate. Let's imagine this: you put out a sort of a middle of the road deal that people think is realistic, and you throw it out into the debate, and you're going to get people hammering it from right and left, and you got a flavor of that, and you see that actually the con arguments are more persuasive to more people than the pro arguments. So. And you already saw the pessimism and the basis of that pessimism. Well, so after going through this, then we ask them whether they should recommend accepting the deal or rejecting the deal. And we reread the package to them because by now they have forgotten the package. So we reread the package to them, and here's what we get. It's really interesting. Among Israelis, 54% of Israelis say I would accept this deal. And 46% of Israelis say I would not accept this deal. And obviously you see a lot more support among Arabs. So, but it's 50, the Jewish population is divided exactly in half, 50-50. And when you add the Arab percentages, you get 54% of Israelis say I accept this deal. And I want to walk you through it in a minute. Of course, we'll provide you with what we think is an explanation. We obviously don't have enough data to be sure, but we think we understand what's happening here. But you can see this in the process. Now, we follow up among those people who say that the deal should be rejected. So we follow up with a question, which is, essentially, why are you rejecting the deal? Is it because you think it would be better to terminate the negotiations than to accept this framework for a package deal? Or do you think the Palestinian Authority will not really accept such a framework for a package deal? So there is no point in saying that you would accept it. So essentially, we know, I mean, part of the early polling that we've done, particularly the one I have done in the past, where we've noticed that you have the Israeli and Palestinian and Arab public broadly pessimistic, but they say they want a two-state solution. So the question is, how do you reconcile the two? And one part of it was the assumption that at least some of them thought there's no point in accepting because the other side will never accept it. And so we put that to them, and you see that there is a certain percentage of Israelis who actually think that's why they're rejecting, because they don't think the Palestinians would ever accept it. And so then we go to them and say, well, assuming the Palestinian Authority does accept the package deal, what would you then recommend? And so in that case, we pick up 9 more percentage points in total of people who support it. And so we end up having, the initial 54% and 9% of people among those who will do so if they believe that the Palestinian Authority would accept it, and then you end up with 63% acceptance. Again, it's very hard to reconcile given what I walked you through before, but I'm going to come back to it. Let me go through it with the Palestinian side. When we ask the Palestinians accept or reject, actually the initial reaction is worse than the Israelis. that 41% of Palestinians recommend rejecting it, and 59% of Palestinians recommend accepting it. So recall that Israelis had a majority accepting it initially, before we followed up. And so we followed up with a question with the Palestinians again. Would you say that you recommend rejecting such a package because you think it would be better to terminate the negotiations and to accept this framework for package deal, or because you think the Israeli government will not really accept it? And we have, you can see, 28% who say because they don't think the Israelis will accept it. So we follow up again, assuming that the Israeli government does accept the deal, what would you then say? Well, it turns out that we pick up 18 percentage point of those who had rejected, of the 18% of the total population, who would then support the deal. And so what you end up having, interestingly, the 41 initial percent plus 18%, 59%, which is very close to the Israelis. So it's the mistrust and the gloom is actually very interesting. So this is the happy story, in a way, if you want to see some overlap. But let me complicate it even more than that, because this is obviously the bottom line that's really fascinating. It needs explanation. But I'm going to go through a little bit more complication, because, the negotiations are now going issue by issue to try to figure out what the limits are on final status issues. So there is a need to find out, you know, sort of what are the sources of their objections, what elements they find most objectionable, and also to look at their limits on each one of the issues. So we followed up here with a question, which elements of deal most objectionable? We asked them, which two elements did you find most objectionable? So they could identify two. And what we had, here are the leading for the Israelis. The most objectionable terms for the Israelis were Jerusalem, the terms on Jerusalem, and the borders. To go to the 67 border with 3 to 4% annexation. Those were the two. So you have 59% say the number one, and 55% say number two. And by the way, most of the others didn't get much at all. These really were the ones that preoccupied the Israelis. Among Palestinians, a little more complicated, but we had the leading objections were, again, Jerusalem. And remember, you know, Jerusalem, Camp David 2 in 2000 failed in large part because of Jerusalem, and people underestimating how important that question is. But again, this is the issue where both sides find very problematic. And the second thing that is a bit of interesting is that the second element that the Palestinians find objectionable is the recognition of Israel as a Jewish as state of a Jewish people and of all its citizens, which we put in the package deal. Let me go through very quickly the final status issues, dealing with them separately. See how, now we have put the package deal in front of them. They reacted to the package deal. We know how they debated it, so to speak, through the pros and cons, and then ultimately what the bottom line is to a package deal. We wanted to see the intensity of positions on each one of the specific issues, the elements, to see whether when you deal with them individually, they react the same way or differently. And we asked them essentially to react to each one of the issues on a scale from 0 to 10, where 0 is completely unacceptable. You know, that's the way to identify the most hardened positions, to 10, which is completely acceptable, and then just in between is 5. And so obviously a lot of numbers in between. So we started off with the final status issue of Jerusalem. And here you can see that if you give them the options for Jerusalem, option number one, which is Israel would have sovereignty over all of Jerusalem, east and west, of course you're going to get 77% of Israelis essentially supporting it, but you have the overwhelming majority of the Palestinians from, you know, 60% saying no, and obviously 31% somewhere in the middle. When you give them the option of Palestinians would have sovereignty over Arab neighborhoods, Israel would have sovereignty over Jewish neighborhoods, and there would be special international status for the walled city, there's actually more common ground. You can see that 50% of Israelis find it somewhat acceptable, at least, and then you have 37% of the Palestinians finding it somewhat acceptable. You find that when you ask them whether they want shared Palestinian-Israeli sovereignty over the walled city, there is a few more Palestinians who say, yes, you have essentially half of both overlap. Just very quickly on settlements, I'm just going to go through a couple of the slides. I don't want to go through them very quickly, but I just want to point out how hardened the positions are on some of these final status issues. If you look at the settlements, one option, of course, is all Israelis would be evacuated from the West Bank. You have major support from the Palestinians. But you do have significant support from the Israelis. It's polarized. You can see you have 37% say absolutely no, zero. I mean, that's pretty strong. But you do have 43% who say yes. So it's kind of more people say yes than no. But you can get a flavor of the positions on the settlements. I'm going to go through the settlements quickly because I want to move to the refugee issue, which I think is a difficult one. Refugees and their families would be allowed to return to Israel or the Palestinian states as they wish. That's one alternative, obviously. On that one, you have, of course, you know, overwhelming majority of Palestinians, you know, leaning in that direction. But you have half of the Israelis say no, and only 29% say yes. But still, that might strike you as a lot for 29%. Remember, again, roughly 15% of the sample is Arabs. 14 to 15% of the sample is Arab citizens of Israel who are mostly on that side of the equation. So it shouldn't come as a big surprise that number is a little bit bigger. Refugees and their families would be allowed to settle in the new Palestinian state, but not in Israel. Actually, you have more than half support for this possibility, which is interesting. Remember, this is not Palestinian refugees who are in Jordan and Lebanon, and just keep that in mind. This is people in the West Bank and Gaza, right? That's what we're doing. We're polling only people in the West Bank and Gaza. Refugees and their families would be allowed to settle in the new Palestinian state, with small number being allowed to settle in Israel. We have 40% of Israelis say yes, 66% of Palestinians say yes. So it's interesting that when you look at these issues, issue by issue, you get more hardened positions than when you look at the package. Not surprising, but it's very important to keep in mind. I'm going to just go through one more issue that is now in the news related to the security forces, and then I want to go through the alternatives to the two-state solution. Some Israeli forces would have a presence along the Jordan River indefinitely. Not surprisingly, few Palestinians accept that. Many Israelis accept that. No foreign forces would be stationed inside the Palestinian state. Israelis are divided on that, slightly more supportive. Palestinians obviously are fine with that. A Western force under American command, possibly NATO, would have a presence along the Jordan River. Israelis are very comfortable with that. Palestinians are divided on that. It's very clear. Now, Israel as state of the Jewish people. Now, this one, of course, is central because Israelis have been insisting on that. And I want to show you something on this one because we had basically given them the option. I want to give you two things on this because one of the issues of negotiations is that the Israelis have been demanding agreement or acknowledgement by the Palestinians on this issue before the end of the negotiations. So we asked Israelis on this, do you demand that or not? That's one question. The other question is, people have been asking about identifying Israel as a Jewish state straightforward. We have introduced a formulation in prior years called state, the Israel as a state of the Jewish people and of all its citizens, so that non-Jewish citizens of Israel would also be equal with Israelis. So I want to give you sort of the reaction among both Israelis and Palestinians on that. So Palestinians to accept Israel as a Jewish state before the conclusion of the negotiations, 82%, of course, support that among Israelis, 52% of Palestinians reject that. For Palestinians to accept Israel as a Jewish state and of all its citizens, you still have a large majority of Israelis accept that. And that's actually in harmony with what we found in previous polls. This is not new. We have a majority of Israeli Jews even accepting the idea that Israel be defined as a state of the Jewish people and of all its citizens as a formula. But still, among Palestinians, you don't have much support even for that. Scenarios for the future. I want to just end by sort of giving you a flavor of why it is that, given how hard their positions are on final status issues individually and how pessimistic they are, why it is that they end up accepting a final status deal over which they have ambivalence on item by item. And one answer is that they don't like the alternatives. And we go through the alternatives, and here's what they are. As you may know, some people are saying that conditions are changing in the West Bank such that it may soon become simply impossible to implement a two-state solution. Imagine if both sides to were to generally come to the conclusion that a two-state solution is not possible, how likely do you think each of the following outcomes would then be? And we give them certain outcomes. So one outcome is the status quo would continue indefinitely with little change. Well, it's interesting. This is Palestinians. I thought we had the Israelis first, but this time we have the Palestinians first. Okay. 81% see it as likely, but we also ask them whether they see it as positive or negative, whether they, on a scale, whether they find it attractive as an outcome. So while 81% see it as likely among Palestinians, 28% don't like it. Only 28% find it acceptable. There would be more intense conflict and instability for years to come. We have 76% saying that, and only 25% find it as positive among the Palestinians. Israel and the Palestinian territories would become one state, but Palestinians would not be fully equal citizens in order to maintain Israel as a Jewish state. We have 60% see that as likely, but only 22% find it as positive. Israel would eventually annex the West Bank, but not Gaza, and expel some Palestinians from the West Bank to assure a robust Jewish majority. You have 54% Palestinians believing this is possible or likely, and 22%, majority not seeing it as positive. And you go through the options, all of them, in terms of you find that there's none. Look at the numbers just on the right side of this thing. Very few people see this as positive. On the Israeli side, you go through some of the same scenarios. The 77% believe the status quo would continue, but 30% see it as positive. There would eventually be intense conflict and instability for years to come. 61%, 41% see it as positive. So you go through it. There's none of the options really capture their imagination. And I think that's the reason why ultimately they're reluctantly accept the deal. Just two final details on issues that were not related to the final status deal, timely issues. One is Iran. This is among Israelis. We asked questions about Iran specifically. One question is, how likely do you think it is that Iran will eventually develop nuclear weapons? And you can see that a majority of Israelis think that it is very likely, and an overwhelming majority think it's at least somewhat likely, and only 8% say not likely. So it's amazing how many the percentage of Israelis who think is likely. And then we asked whether they support the negotiations or the diplomatic deal with Iran as long as the deal would have clear verification requirements, as the administration is suggesting. Well, interestingly, 54% say they support diplomatic deal. 46% say they think they oppose diplomatic effort, and they believe that Iran can only be prevented from acquiring nuclear weapons through sanctions and ultimately the possible use of force. Just a quick note on this is that if you look at Arabs and Jews on this one, you have Jews are split exactly in the middle on this question, and Arabs are overwhelmingly in favor of a diplomatic solution. The final question is on Egypt, which is about the overthrow of Morsi. As you may know, the elected president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, was overthrown last June. Would you say his removal is better for Israel, worse for Israel, the same for Israel? You can see that a slight majority, about half, 51%, say the same as before, but a few more people say it's better for Israel, 35% to 14%. And similarly, question on the Israeli-Egyptian treaty, whether they think that it will remain in force in its present form, whether it'll remain in force and modified, and it will be terminated. Interestingly, only 13% believe it'll be terminated, although a slight majority believe it will remain in force but will be modified. And I'll end with that. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Shibley, thank you so much. That was fascinating, and I think there are a lot of questions about some of those findings and to what extent they represent sort of contradictory impulses amongst the Israelis and Palestinians who were surveyed. I want to get to that as well as what you think the implications are for American efforts to mediate in these negotiations, what the policy choices are facing the United States at this moment, especially as we see Secretary Kerry finishing up his latest trip to the region after hours of meetings both with Netanyahu and with Mahmoud Abbas, and at least the press reports, we don't know if they're accurate, suggest that he didn't make a lot of headway. But before we get to all of that, Steve, I want to ask you if you can help us understand this policymaking simulation.
Yeah.
Because this is not your typical survey methodology. And it produced some fascinating results that people may not like the components of a peace agreement, but if they're presented with a package and they have to look at the trade-offs, they might change their views. So can you tell us, you know, what does this method reveal? Why is it a useful tool?
Yeah. If you look at a lot of polling in Israel and the Palestinian territories that go through issue by issue, you kind of come away with a depressed feeling like, oh, this is hopeless. They're never going to get anywhere. But so it's somewhat surprising that when you put it all together in a big package, we actually got a fairly large number. It's really that there's a different mentality depending upon how you ask the question. And a policy-making simulation is meant to get people to step back, think about it in a big picture, and think about it like a policymaker. We actually even said, imagine that you're advising the prime minister and they come in and they say, this is the best deal we think we can get. What do you think we should do? Now, I was trying to think about something comparable for what Americans we see in the United States. And if you say to Americans, do you want to balance the budget? Yeah. Do you want to raise taxes? Do I want to raise taxes? No, no, no. Do you want to cut spending in this area, this area, this area? Oh, no, 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 no. So it seems like the public is just kind of incoherent. But it turns out, though, if you say, okay, here's how everything's organized, here's the budget, here are the revenue sources, what do you think ought to happen? In that context, they do actually cut the deficit quite a lot. They go into a different mentality of thinking about the big picture. Now, a lot of polling is just trying to get a reaction out of people. You know, are you going to get upset if that happens? They're not really trying to get people to deliberate, to really think, you know, to act in a reasoning fashion. And this really does pose a challenge, I think, to policymakers. How are you going to work with a population? Are you going to try to build that mentality that is more holistic, that is more integrated, that thinks about the long term, deals with the trade-offs and so on? Or are you going to try to play on these kind of centrifugal forces? And obviously, both of those things are going to happen. Now, there's another aspect, too, that you're dealing with in the Israeli-Palestinian situation, which is that, you know, there is a bargaining situation, and you kind of go to one side and you say, well, you know, are you willing to give that up? Well, and there's a real strong incentive to go, no, you know, I will never, never. You know, it feels like, particularly if you think the other side is not really willing to give in. And so it's like, I'm going to look tough as long as I think the other side's looking tough. And that can go on forever. You're going to have this spiral. So both sides can be saying, well, I would have, he would, but I know he won't, so I'm not going to. And you can turn over to the other side and see the exact same thing going on, and this thing just can go on for a long time. And there are a lot of indications to some extent that is what appears to be going on. So we were trying to get us, how do we get around that? And first thing, we try to put people in that kind of holistic mode where they're thinking about the trade-offs, thinking about the big picture. And then we took the people who said that they wouldn't do it, who are opposed. Are you saying this because you really don't want to do it? You think it's a bad idea, or you don't want to say that because you don't really think the other side's going to, so in any case, why would I want to, right? Why would I want to come out and say that? And about half of the people who resisted said, it's not that I'm really opposed, I just don't want to say it, right? And then we said, well, okay, if the other side would say it, would you say it? And then a lot of people said, well, yeah, and if they would, I would, you know, or if they would, I think we should. And then through all that, suddenly you have, you know, 6 in 10 on both sides. It was actually 59% of Israeli Jews and 59% of Palestinians, plus more of the Israeli Arabs. So through that process, you can kind of, one, get people in the holistic mode, and the other, get them around or out of this kind of bargaining, trying to compete with the other side in terms of who's tougher and who's taking the harder line.
Steve, thanks. That's a great explanation. So you have to get past the staring contest and overcome that confidence gap, get people to see the big picture. It seems to me then, if you look at these findings, is this survey telling us that the United States would be wise to put forward its own package proposal to the two sides?
Well, I'm going to answer that, but I want to do something that I forgot to do that I should have done, which is thank a lot of people who work on this report, particularly Evan Lewis and Claire Ramsey, who are here. I just want to give you a flavor. We were polling all the way to the weekend. We didn't get the final results until Tuesday. And putting all that material and analyzing it, people had to work around the clock to get this analysis done. It was a fantastic team effort. And really, thanks, Evan and Clay, and everyone else, including my assistant, Katayun Kishi, and Ashley Sharp, who work with this. And I want to thank the U.S. Institute of Peace for helping us co-sponsor this. Yes. I think, you know, let's put it this way. I started off by mentioning Mandela. And I think, so what's Mandela? You know, why Mandela? Well, and it's, you know, Mandela is many things. I mean, for a lot of people, I mean, he stands for freedom. He stands for justice. He stands for nonviolent resistance, et cetera. But he stands for an incredibly bold leader who gets over the bitterness that prevents compassion in moving forward. And you know, there are a few people like Mandela, and let's face it, we can't really dream of one coming up tomorrow on either the Israeli or the Palestinian or the Arab side. It's there are very few and far between. That's why we're this is such an incredible moment, losing a man of that magnitude. So where does it then leave it? Because I think if you start with the conclusion that Israelis and Palestinians believe deal isn't going to happen, if you believe it's not going to happen, you're an idiot to compromise. Because why would you give something up, and then you're given something up, and then you're dealing with conflict? Instead, you start preparing for the conflict instead of preparing. So first of all, you're not going to compromise on your own. Second, why would you compromise on issue by issue when there's issue linkage? How you know, why would you do it? I mean, you have particular, the only reason you'd give up on one issue is that you're going to get some more on another issue. It's indivisible. You can't do it. So to think, number one, that they're going to do it on their own, given the pessimism that is not likely to be overcome, and B, that you're going to do it by negotiating issue by issue, I think is a delusion. And so therefore, yes, I think the only way you can move forward is at some point to put a package deal on the table. And neither side is capable of putting that package deal by default on the table. And so who does that leave? So yes, now it doesn't guarantee success. Mm-hmm. What we, the public opinion is receptive to it, given leadership. If an Israeli government says no and they want to persuade the Israeli public, they can sway them. But if they want to accept it, they can persuade them to accept it. Mm-hmm. The same thing with the Palestinians. So I think that's why, in my own view, we're reaching a point where if there is no American plan on the table, after feeling out all the limits, it's impossible for me to imagine that we can move forward.
But it's also, it's a certain kind of plan. It's a comprehensive plan.
Right.
Borders first, for example, which is a proposal put forward when the talks were restarted, isn't going to work. You have to look at all these pieces together and put forward a comprehensive proposal that Israelis and Palestinians then stare in the face, compare to the alternatives, and make their choice.
Absolutely.
I'm struck, too, by what Israelis and Palestinians think might happen if there's no agreement, and the arguments that they feel are compelling in favor of accepting a compromise, even though they don't like its elements. Israelis seem driven to support an agreement or to accept an agreement mainly by the fear of violence if there isn't one. Is that an accurate reading?
Yeah, the alternative, they don't like what's going on. And so what's attractive is the option of the possibility of some peace. If you take each item, each item in the list is not necessarily attractive. So it's only when they're looking at the whole that you see something, the possibility of peace that gets people ready to stomach things that they don't like in the package. And something that really drives them forward, that really comes through in this study, is that there is no other option that they think is both attractive and likely.
No other option they would rather live with than an imperfect agreement.
That they think is likely, yeah. I mean, you can imagine things that they would... But it was interesting, even ones with them being in this very dominant position, were not all that popular either. So it's... And that, that... They can maybe get engaged by those fantasies at times, but when they really come down and think about it, they don't really think it's realistic, and that pushes them back toward the two-state
solution.
Yeah, I mean,
the key here is that you're trying to find their assessment of what they think is likely and desirable.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no option that they think is both likely and desirable. None.
And yet half of Israelis and half of Palestinians, when you go into the report you put together, half of them each say, we don't need a deal. Israel doesn't need a deal right now. We can live without one. We're okay. And half of Palestinians say the same thing.
Well, they're not saying that's a case that they mm-hmm. can try to make, and buttress themselves up with it. We don't need a deal. But it's clear from the totality of their responses that's not necessarily
that's
attractive.
But I also think that there's a little bit of a divided self on this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that people, these are not good choices. None of them are good choices. So people aren't embracing a deal. People are saying, I can live with this. And so, yes, they're divided. And again, when you have an assessment that's not going to happen, you start protecting yourself against that possibility. And so there's a lot that goes into it, and particularly when you see the degree of pessimism. I mean, how could you protect yourself? Like, I can live with this, or what? Am I going to give in? So, but if you give me something realistic, I might reconsider.
If you think the other side is ready to live with it, then you better damn well be ready to live with it, right? So I'm going to solidify myself in that position, and as long as that perception, that pessimistic perception continues, it's going to be hard to get people off of that.
One other seemingly contradictory finding that I wanted to ask you about and then open it up to questions from the floor, asking about alternatives to the two-state solution, what will happen without an agreement. It seemed that both Israelis and Palestinians expected one of two things. Either the status quo will continue indefinitely or there'll be a disaster. It'll be violent and unstable and miserable. How do we explain this?
Well, you know, it's interesting, actually, because the status quo, I mean, we tried to figure out, you know, how many of the people who expected something like the status quo violence were for or against an agreement. Mm-hmm. And we didn't find strong correlations except with one variable, which is among Israelis, people who thought the status quo will continue were most likely to oppose the deal. And that, I think, in large part, because, as you know, many Israelis think, so what's wrong with it? You know, we're okay. I mean, not all Israelis, but a good segment of Israelis. So it's fascinating that you have that kind of expectation. But it's not surprising that, you know, you'd have those two. The status quo is always the default thing. And about whether or not you're going to have a conflict is really sort of a probability assessment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, historically, it goes along with some degree of stability, not unlike the present, then it gets worse with these intifadas. And so there is the sense that we're just barely, you know, staying above water, and then we occasionally sink, so that there isn't a sense that there's some way on the present trajectory it's really going to get better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me open it up then for questions from the floor, and let me ask you, please, A, wait for the mic. B, identify yourself. C, ask a question. That's a singular question. And we'll start here with Mohammed Al-Shinawi.
Mohammed Shinawi, Voice of America. We noticed in the survey that both sides are not confident of the American negotiating part. What would make the U.S. more efficient in negotiating? And the latest round proved that the Americans are interested in serving Israel by talking about security, but not showing any interest in serving the Palestinian side by talking about how to do the settlements.
Mohammed, one of the things that's interesting is that while they don't show a lot of confidence in the American mediators, they show no confidence in their own negotiators, including the Israelis. In fact, they show less confidence in their own negotiators. I would posit to you that it's a function of their pessimism, that they just think, you know, they're starting with the pessimism, it's not going to happen, this is all an exercise, they've seen it before. And there's nothing, I think, procedurally by the U.S. that will transform their expectations. Success is it's its own answer. But if we think that there's something tactical that we could do in the short term to transform expectation, it's not going to happen. We're way past beyond that point. It's that these attitudes are built in based on a long experience, and they can't be transformed with tactics.
Okay, although we could also say that the low expectations and the pessimism so far to some extent has protected the talks from risks of failure. If expectations were high and the talks broke down, you know, then the publics might react very badly. This way we can expect a sort of, we figured that would happen if the talks break down. All right, Said.
Thank you. My name is Said Erkat from Al-Quds Daily newspaper, and I want to ask Shibley, do you find that more and more Israelis are less and less interested or enthusiastic about a settlement with the Palestinians? Because that's what one concludes in reading what has happened over the past few years. Let's say more than more than, let's say, a generation ago or so?
Well, I don't know that our numbers particularly indicate that, but I think with the trend, I think what we have seen over, particularly in previous polls that I've done in Israel itself, among Israeli Jews especially, because we do both Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs, and in the past I've done them separately, and that what we've seen is that more and more people had gotten comfortable with the status quo. That's why I said, you know, the status quo is, so what's wrong with the status quo argument? There are also demographic changes, obviously, in Israel that have hardened positions. But I think despite that, I mean, what's interesting about this finding here is that we're talking about all these changes, we're talking about this hardening of position, and yet you have a plan as a compromise plan that some people think is something, you know, you can give and take, but it's going to be something roughly like this that would be put on the table. And yet you have a majority of Israelis accepting it. And even among Israeli Jews, you have half and half without even the follow-up of saying, what if the Palestinians accept it? So I don't read that as necessarily hardening. On specific issues, I think the positions are hardened. But I think on a package deal, we have no point of comparison, by the way, on the package deal, because we have never put a package deal like that to them. So we don't know whether they would have accepted it 2 years ago or a year ago or now. I'm not sure about that. But at least, you know, if you look at it, you would, starting with your statement, would lead you to believe they would never accept such a deal, and yet they say they would.
I think it's more that they've gotten more pessimistic than that they've gotten less interested. But pessimism can translate into, it'll never happen, and so why bother even saying I want it?
Okay, let's take a question on this side, on the aisle there.
Hello, my name is Fakhira. I am Palestinian citizen of Israel. So, Chibli, can you elaborate a little bit why you think the majority of the Israeli became to accept Israel as a Jewish state for the Jewish people and for all citizens? What's the reasons became?
Sorry, Chibli, if you have your cell phone in your pocket, can you just take it out?
I have it
interfering.
In my pocket.
There we go.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'll
That's
let me
okay.
just make
it
sure it's, well, let me make sure it's off. It's interesting because when the Obama administration started the mediation effort with Special Envoy George Mitchell, people were talking about this insistence of acknowledging a Jewish state. One of the argument was that this works against the Arab citizens of Israel. I mean, what about them if it's just a Jewish state? What about Israel's democracy? If you're balancing Israel's democracy and its Jewishness, where's the democracy part? And so we tried this formulation, which is a state of the Jewish people and of all its citizens. We asked them a direct question in Israeli among Israeli Jews. I believe it was three years in a row. And every time we asked the Israeli Jews whether they accept such formulation, we have a strong majority accept such formulation. I think that, just like the right of return issue, I didn't go through the right of return issue. Palestinians don't want to compromise on the right of return. Even when you say, but, you know, Palestinians can go back to the Palestinian state, but it's like the Jewishness of Israel issue is so part of Israeli identity, and the right of return issue is so part of the Palestinian identity, and so the real question is not the principle of it. So it's like with the Palestinians. The Palestinians say, you have to accept our right of return, then we'll accept. As you can see, in practice, they accept the idea that most refugees will go to the Palestinian state, not to Israel. But they still insist on the right of return as an acknowledgement, as a moral acknowledgement. I think you find the same thing among Israelis, among Israeli Jews, where they want this character of a Jewish state, but if they have it, they also are prepared to to deal on the other. That's my own interpretation of what you have there.
Yeah, it was striking how many Israelis were comfortable with that formulation.
Right.
Okay, over here.
Hi, Anat Saragusti, Director of B'Tselem USA. My question is, do you suggest that the American administration will try to shift the public opinion or speak directly to the public opinion and kind of sell, you know, the plan directly to the public opinion over the heads of the leaders, given the fact that both Israelis and Palestinians don't really believe in the process?
I can't tell you what they plan because I have no idea what they plan. I doubt it personally for a variety of reasons. But let's think about it differently. Would that work? Right? I mean, that's the really more interesting question. Would that work? I don't know. I can't tell you, but I could tell you that we have more confidence that if Israeli and Palestinian leaders accept it, they can sell it to the public. That there is a but if they reject it, and the intensity of the con argument would increase, would they then be able to, you know, would the public sway with them? It's an open argument. It really is. I do note, however, something interesting, which is that on the Iran debate, you have an official Israeli position that is very, very opposing of the agreement that has just been, reached with Iran. And obviously, Israeli public that has come to believe that Iran, you know, that nuclear Iran is an existential threat. It's part of the discourse. And yet they're far more open to diplomatic effort than the government would suggest. So this is not a secondary issue. You know, we're talking about if it's a marginal issue, you could say, well, yeah, but this is not a marginal issue. So there's a space. I don't know how wide that space is. I'm not sure.
But you're saying there's a degree of realism, I guess?
Yes, I think the degree of realism is... Here's what I think has happened among Israelis and Palestinians. I think that we have reached a point where no one can pretend that the two-state solution is not near the end if it hasn't passed the point. So it's a moment of decision. You're going to have to decide. You're going to live with this, or you're not going to live with this, but it's not going to happen again. And I think this kind of this may be the last chance. They might stretch it a little bit, but it's sort of the mentality of it is that I think propels people into more serious assessment in the debate than before.
Do you have anything to add? All right, why don't we take one or two more? We'll start here. Right there, in the pink sweater. Yep.
Hi, Lucy Kutzer, Alan Bogan, U.S. Institute of Peace. This is a related question to Annette's, which is, given the very compelling sort of psychology you painted as to why this particular framing gives you some seemingly contradictory answers, what implications does this have for you for what a referendum might look like, need to look like, or process leading up to a referendum, assuming you're trying to get to yes?
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I could tell you sort of my own assessment of this is that if you have leaders support it, and it's roughly along lines that we discussed, I think it would pass a referendum. If you have leaders oppose it, and you're going over their head, as the question suggested, I don't have full confidence that it would. Now, it doesn't mean that shouldn't be tried or whatever. I mean, at some point, the administration is going to have tough decisions to make, including if it can't get them to agree on anything at all, does it put a plan anyway and take it to the UN and then make it more of an international legal and moral issue? And then force people to react over a long period of time. It's not about short-term accepting or rejecting, may essentially tying people's hands in what might become possible. There are all sorts of things that you can do, but that's another question.
I think the survey really provides recipes for a leader who wants to provoke people and get those centrifugal forces going and pulling them this way and that way. You can see through the pro and con arguments which ones really work. But you can also see how you can try to build that center, how you can try to build that common ground within the society and between the societies. So what I don't think this survey dictates anything about what the outcome is going to be or what leaders have to do. And I certainly don't think that the United States can in some way intervene and go over the heads of the leaders. The leaders can blow this thing apart if they want to. But what it does say is that they can actually pull it together to a greater extent than they have.
So if maybe I'm reading into your answer, and if so, tell me. Israelis are dug in on what they like and don't like, and we have many years of data on that, but they're not dug in on what they'll live with. There is a malleability to opinion here.
Yes. On that 0 to 10 scale, it's very important to look at how many people said 0, right? And in every case, it's never more than 1 in 3, and so often it's less than that. So, I mean, even if you're at 1 on that series, you're going, well, maybe under certain circumstances I'll consider it or something like that. So you do not have very many people who are just naysayers. You do have some, and you're going to hear from them if anything happens, but they are not necessarily representative. Though they say things that resonate with the majority, but so does the other side. And it's really important to see that people are not, you almost want to say, well, do they favor or oppose? As if they're little, you know, billiard balls of clear intent and opinion. And people are not that way. They have a kind of inner parliament, and there are only a small number of people who are highly crystallized on one side or the other. And leaders have to say, find themselves, you know, navigate between those forces and build. And what this says is that they have been underestimating what is possible with their publics.
Interesting. So for a political entrepreneur, there's opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. We'll take one last question up here. Yep.
Thank you very much, Benjamin Tua, no affiliation. One of the most startling answers, I thought, was the one that answered the question, Israel and the Palestinian territories would become one state, but Palestinians would not be fully equal citizens in order to maintain Israel as a Jewish state. And 22% of the Palestinians thought that would be a positive result. That's an astoundingly large number, it seems to me. Perhaps it suggests that they see benefits in being citizens of Israel, even if not equally on an equal basis with Jews. What are your ideas?
I just think that, yes, it's a small number, but it's saying it's an image of some kind of stability, that they're no longer occupied, that they have some rights, even if they're in some kind of secondary position. So, you know, 22%, those 22% aren't saying, I favor that, that's my, you know, preferred outcome. It's they say, well, I can imagine maybe tolerating that, and that there might be some benefits to that.
It's more I can live with it, and also we haven't, you know, we as I told you, we got the data very close. So some of these differentiations are important. For example, when you look at the where the poll took place, it took place certainly all over the West Bank and all over Gaza, but also in East Jerusalem, and whereas a substantial Palestinian population that is far more integrated, even though it is, you know, Palestinian. So we haven't actually looked at the differences from community to community of people who are prepared to tolerate because it's more comfortable for them. But there are all sorts of reasons why people do that. I mean, look at Arab citizens of Israel and look at their attitudes, even voting behavior. Some of them vote for the ultra-Orthodox right-wing parties. And some of them vote for Likud. In fact, some members of Likud. So you have to ask, you know, how is this possible? Well, it's politics, and it's, you know, it's attitudes, and it's interests, and yeah, it's they're minorities, but they're, you know, sizable minorities of people who do that.
I see it as that weakening confidence in the possibility of a two-state solution.
And figuring out what else they can live with.
Right.
Okay. So I think you have succeeded, at least for me, I don't know about you, in finding some reasons for hope, and definitely some room for maneuver for politicians in these survey findings. But I guess another lesson I would draw from this is that when expectations are so low, there's nowhere to go but up.
Yeah.
So with that, I want to thank you both. I want to thank the University of Maryland for providing the platform for you to do this work, and thank you for bringing it to Brookings. Thanks to USIP for sponsoring it, and we look forward to seeing the next round of results. Thanks very much for coming, folks.